Oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the threshold issue presented by this appeal is whether the First Amendment provides a right of access to post-indictment material witness proceedings under 18 U.S.C. 3144. While that specific issue may technically be one of first impression, there can be very little question that under existing Supreme Court precedent, existing precedent of this court, and of the other circuits, the First Amendment does provide a qualified right of access to post-indictment material witness hearings. That right is derived from decades-old Supreme Court cases, beginning with Richmond Newspapers, the landmark decision, Richmond Newspapers, and is probably best represented in this circuit by Washington Post versus Robinson. In that decision, this court held very plainly that, quote, the First Amendment guarantees the press and the public a general right of access to court proceedings and court documents unless there are compelling reasons demonstrating why it cannot be observed. Now, the government asked this court to go against 30 years of court access cases and issue the very first opinion from any court holding that a post-indictment proceeding, judicial proceeding, is precluded from First Amendment protection and from the First Amendment right of access.
Let me stop you, because we sent it back for her to remove the two-point enhancement, which she did. And this whole unfortunate discussion of the multiplicity of girls and so forth is what has led you to bring this case back up again. I mean, why can't we just say the district judge was given the instruction to remove the two-point enhancement, resentence him, end of story? To the extent she did anything other than that, or in addition to that, she was not authorized to do that on the basis of the remand, a limited remand.
Well, Your Honor, that would be, I think, relevant to the appeal of the appellant's resentencing in his criminal case. In this case, in the two cases that are consolidated here, appellant stands in the shoes of the public and not as a criminal defendant. Now, I think his status as a criminal defendant may have a certain relevance to perhaps the common law right of access issue. But in terms of the First Amendment issue, this wouldn't necessarily have had to have been filed on behalf of appellant. A news organization could have come in. Any other member of the public could have come in and filed the same request for an unsealing that appellant did in this case. So really, this is independent, separate and apart from the criminal case, which is being held in abeyance just while this action is pending.
I'm not sure that helps you, because the whole reason you want the information is for your appeal.
Well, you know, why we want the information, again, I don't think is necessarily relevant. I mean, a news organization can come in and stand in the same shoes as us, and their particular motives for wanting it, I'm not sure, are salient. But what is salient is that the burden is not on appellant to demonstrate any kind of need or anything else to get access to the materials. The burden is very much under the First Amendment on the government to demonstrate a compelling reason why the materials should be kept non-public and kept under seal. And the government cannot carry that burden here.
Your argument is for the Washington Post test to be applied.
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't that what the district court did?
Well, the district court did that at the very...
So even assuming you're right about your threshold point, assuming arguendo you're right about that, it seems that the district court applied the Washington Post factor, certainly cited them.
I would agree that the district court cited the case at the very conclusion of its order. However, the district court assumed, I think without deciding, that applied. Appellant had argued that it applied. However, the district court engaged in none of the analysis that was incumbent on it under a long line of Supreme Court cases, this court's cases, saying that when the analysis is under the Washington Post versus Robinson test is called Other Things in Other Circuits, really comes from Richmond newspapers. But when the analysis is under that test, the findings must be case specific and they must be on the record. They must be detailed. They cannot be conclusory assertions about how those factors play out. And particularly with respect to the court's consideration of less restrictive alternatives to total closure of the cases, which is a fairly extraordinary remedy, total closure of the cases. In consideration, considering less restrictive alternatives, there was no consideration by the district court on the record, either in its order or otherwise, of less restrictive alternatives to total closure of those cases. And that is a
What alternatives did you ask for?
Down there, we in our opening motion, we asked for access under, that I'll quote directly, under quote whatever reasonable conditions the court deems appropriate. So we essentially said, however the court wants to do this, under the many, many, many different tools that district courts have to redact material, to keep sensitive material under non-public, under the many tools that a district court has, we would accept disclosure under any of those considerations, under any of those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
can't you read the district court's opinion as saying that disclosure of any of this information is going to be violative of the privacy interests of the girls here?
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court and this court's been very clear that there is a procedural prerequisite here. The district courts must go through procedural requirements, and those procedural requirements are that they put on the record what alternatives it considered, and if it rejects the alternatives, why those alternatives are not.
Well, as to the latter, it seems that the reasoning is there in the district court's opinion.
Well, I think the district
doesn't specifically discuss, as you, I acknowledge, okay, well, we're going to consider redactions now, but it does give the reason why disclosure of any of this information would be problematic, right after it cites the three factors from Washington Post.
And I think that really goes to the first prong, which is the strength of the government's interest. And it is true that the Supreme Court has said that, and we agree, that preventing further trauma and embarrassment to minor witnesses can be a compelling governmental interest, and we fully agree with that. I think really getting down to it, the district court's the flaw here is that the district court viewed this as a trade-off between First Amendment values on the one hand and the privacy or personal rights of these minor witnesses on the other. The privacy and personal rights of these minor witnesses can be fully protected under the Washington Post versus Robinson test. The district court has many different ways of preventing any personal or private information about those witnesses from ever being part of a public disclosure. Redaction, as Your Honor mentioned, is probably the foremost one that we would suggest.
And I think that was obvious. If you were to prevail here and the district court said in great detail that the proceedings involved very personal history, et cetera, that would harm the two girls. That's what you say would be sufficient?
I think there would I think that would have gotten close to complying with the procedural requirements of what needs to be in here. The district court needs to lay out its reasoning in that way, and that needs to be done on remand. But in terms of then there's the substantive question of whether that conclusion is correct. And the order
well, that's then, what I thought you were going to say, and the question is, what issue would be before this court then? Are you asking that then we would look at the sealed proceedings and find out whether or not the district court was correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor. When you hear in this case, I don't even think we get to the substantive issue because the district court so clearly failed to follow the procedural requirements. But if we did get to the substantive question, then I think the substantive choices that were made on the record as required would be something that this court would review.
I mean, I know there's a line of cases about how you have to consider alternatives, but if you say we'll do anything, we'll accept it under any conditions you suggest, and the judge says there are no conditions because this is all very personal history.
Yes, and if the judge had said that, then I think we might be closer to a substantive review by this court of whether that was correct.
And you don't think that's a reasonable reading of the record?
No, Your Honor, and I think that for several reasons. First, much more, the district court in its order and then the government here has focused on the presence of this sensitive information in the record of the material witness hearings. And that is undoubtedly true, that there is that information. But I think that information can be all kept. The First Amendment is much less.
I thought the record was that that's all it was.
Yeah, you're right. I would respectfully submit that there must be much more to those proceedings than the sensitive information about. I mean, determinations were made here. This was made under 3144, which requires the court to make legal determinations that have been shielded from public scrutiny, have been shielded from this court's review, have been shielded from anyone seeing them other than the people that were involved. The First Amendment is going to be at its very height, at its very strongest, when what we're talking about are legal determinations made by the district court judge. Legal determinations made here would include the materiality of the witness's testimony to the proceedings, whether a deposition would have been sufficient to have secured their testimony, whether a subpoena would have been sufficient to secure their testimony, whether a deposition would have been adequate, a deposition that was taken at the time and then they were released. These are all legal determinations that the district court judge had to make under 3144.
And so when the district court issues an order granting the government's motion, doesn't that tell you that under the procedure she has to follow under the Bail Reform Act, that she has concluded that there are no conditions that would suffice to assure the presence of these witnesses at trial?
It would suggest that, Your Honor, but I think the content of that order, the district court's legal reasoning, how it got to that conclusion, the arguments were made by the prosecutor, are all things that should be in the public sphere. And the government offers no reason why the actions of the prosecutor, the actions of the judge, insofar as they don't reveal sensitive information about these minor witnesses, why are those parts of this adjudicative process, post-indictment proceeding, not in the public sphere? I mean, those are things that the First Amendment right of access attaches extremely strongly to when a judge is making decisions, what the judge's reasoning is. You know, as an example, in this case, one thing the judge said that it concluded from the material witness hearings was that 1344 required one of the bases for their detention was that 1344 allowed her to detain them based on their safety and to foster their emotional well-being. Now, is that an appropriate exercise of 3144? Well, that's a very important question, and it's a very serious question. Can a district judge detain someone, or detain maybe just a minor, to foster their emotional well-being and for their own good, is what the district court said. We've researched that. We've seen that haven't seen any authority under 3144 that allows a district court to do that. But in any event, the point is that decision, that legal reasoning, should be something that the public knows about. We're talking about a process where people are detained and deprived of their liberty. It's one of the most serious things that the judicial system can do. And this isn't even someone that's accused of a crime. These are people who are accused of no crime. I think the First Amendment is at its very strongest under the right of access cases, under Press Enterprise, under Globe newspaper, when what we're talking about is detaining people. And it's simply unprecedented to say that a judge's actions in that area, a prosecutor's actions in that area, as far as they're in court, should be shielded from public scrutiny.
But I thought you acknowledged that there's a compelling interest at stake in protecting the privacy of the victims here.
Yes. And, Your Honor, and I think that gives the judge many different ways.
So by acknowledging that, you're acknowledging that in some cases, even accepting, as I do, your First Amendment point, there's going to be times when it's not going to be open to public scrutiny because of the compelling interest.
Yes. I think that's true. If all that was present here was personal information about the minors, if it consisted 100% of that, then it might never, none of that
district
might.
The district judge says the material witness proceedings contain intensely private and painful information about both girls' medical and mental health issues from being caught in Mr. Bryce's pimping web. Substantial amounts of material of an especially personal and private nature related to the medical, educational, mental health progress.
And I think the district court
was familiar with what happened in those proceedings and identifies that as the basis for not revealing any of it.
Well, Well, 2 points on that. The district court doesn't say that that's the only thing that these proceedings consisted of.
If it were the only thing, would it satisfy you?
That might well be the case. That might well be the case. And we agree that there need not be exposure, and that a district court has sufficient tools to prevent the release of any personal or private information about the minor witnesses. And so far as it's along the lines of what they're talking about there. I mean, 3509, 18 U.S.C. 3509, the statute that Congress, frankly, specifically legislated for this kind of scenario, provides a district court with many different tools for preventing the dissemination of sensitive information about minors. The district court could employ all of those tools in 3509 prior to any public dissemination. So I think the choice between honoring the First Amendment and sacrificing their privacy is
the minors in this case, it's going to be the public could figure out who they were.
I don't think that's true. If we're not disclosing anything private about
people,
it.
If the defendant knew who they were, then the public could know who they were. And revealing any information about their mental health or medical histories could be connected to the person and open to the world at large.
Well, again, I think that
if any of it's released.
Under 3509 and under the other just traditional tools district judge has to prevent the release of private information, none of that ever needs to come to light. I don't think any of that never needs to come to light. What does need to come to light is things like legal reasoning of the district court. What does need to come to light, I think, are things that the arguments, especially novel arguments, which appear to have been made in this case. It was rather extraordinary, one of the basis that the district court detained them. Those things should very much come to light, and they should be part of the public debate. And this goes right to the heart of the structural role of the First Amendment in the process. I mean, especially when we're talking about detaining people, the public should know what the judicial system is up to.
All right, you're over your time. We'll give you a couple minutes in reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Nicholson.
May it please the court, my name is Matt Nicholson and I represent the United States in this case. In this matter, Appellant Jaron Brice seeks access to records containing highly personal information about the then juvenile victims of his sexual abuse. Mr. Brice asserts that he has a right of access to these documents under three theories. I will focus on the First Amendment theory as it was mostly discussed in his argument. I think that this court has highlighted a key point here, and that is that even if we assume that the First Amendment qualified right of access attaches to these documents, that the court made the correct finding that that right was overcome. I want to make several points in this regard. First, the court observed that there was a compelling interest in protecting the private information about these young girls from a very painful point in their lives. Second, the court made the common sense observation that disclosing this information would clearly harm that interest. And third, the court found that there were no reasonable alternatives to protect that interest. And Mr. Brice faults the district court for not specifically mentioning the word redaction, but I want to point out a few things in that regard. First, Mr. Brice never expressly asked for redaction. In fact, the only alternative that he proposed was that the documents be given only to his counsel. He never suggested that this information might be removed from them. Second, although the court did not discuss redaction expressly, I think this court in its questions has pointed out the key point that it's implicit in the district court's findings that are there that redaction was not a reasonable alternative here. The court noted that these documents contained intensely private and painful information about these young girls. The court further noted that that amount of information was very substantial. And so I don't think that the court was required to adopt redaction based on these findings here. Furthermore,
I know you make the argument that the defendant also did not cite the statute to the district court, but the district court order cites the statute on two different occasions, so clearly, I mean, she was aware of it.
Yes, Your Honor, the district
and
court.
Just on a hypothetical,
mm-hmm.
I gather appellant this morning has conceded that if the proceedings are 100% intensely personal and private information, the language that Judge Kavanaugh just quoted, then his First Amendment argument fails because of the district court's finding of compelling interest. But I thought he also said, unless the district court makes that finding, that this is 100%, then there is still a right to know the district court's legal reasoning. And the sort of troubling notion that I'm locking you up for your own good.
Right. 2 points on that, Your Honor. First, the legal issues in this case are highly factual, whether there were any combination of conditions that would lead to reasonably assure these witnesses to appear at trial. That was going to turn on the specific facts here.
That's always true in bail Reform Act determinations.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I would point out here that these determinations involve juvenile witnesses, which the other side has conceded there may be a compelling interest in protecting. But to the point about whether there was some impropriety here, because the district court noted that it was necessary to detain these witnesses to foster their...
He wasn't suggesting mm-hmm. impropriety. He was suggesting unlawful detention.
I would just point out that the district court's finding with respect to their emotional well-being, although it sort of appears from this order that may have been an independent basis, the government's filing below makes clear that it was making arguments about the emotional well-being of the juveniles. To go to the second prong under 3144, which is whether...
And we know that because you're making that representation?
Well, it's in the unsealed record.
Yeah.
The government's arguments went toward the second prong.
I gather there was an actual hearing of some in-person hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, there
so
were.
So it wasn't just a paper
determination. Yes, Your Honor, mm-hmm. there was. But I think that... The key point here is that the district court made the finding that no reasonable conditions or combination thereof would permit or would reasonably assure the appearance of these witnesses. And that mention of their emotional health, I think, simply went to that issue, that if the witnesses were very vulnerable and had emotional health issues, it might make it less likely that they would appear at trial subject to subpoena. But I think the key point, I want to return to this.
Can I just say mm-hmm. what's odd to me about this case is here sure. these girls are the victims of this defendant, and that's the whole case. And, I mean, just speculating here, they say, we don't want anything to do with this. This man is dangerous. He has friends in the community. We're going to California. Forget about us as witnesses. And despite the prosecutor's arguments about the greater good, can't persuade them. So a motion is filed. So I just tell you, I mean, that's sort of troubling. And the question is, A, if we're not going the route that Judge Henderson originally suggested, and B, not going the route that Judge Kavanaugh was exploring with appellant's counsel, then is there no avenue for getting a more detailed explanation by the district court?
Well, I would say that the defendant did have certain avenues available to him by which he could have gotten more information about these proceedings. One of them would have been to raise a due process challenge at the sentencing hearing when the court mentioned these proceedings. The defendant did not do so. He could have argued that he had a right to be sentenced based on information that he was privy to. He did not raise that argument. I would also point out the defendant could have, if he had chosen to, raise the Jinx Act argument to try to get some of the statement from one of the witnesses who testified at trial, KH. But he never raised that argument either. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that the government is not suggesting that a defendant in Mr. Bryce's position would never be able to get access to said information. We're just saying that this isn't the right way to go about it. He's opened basically a collateral First Amendment proceeding in which he claims that he's standing in the shoes of the press. But I would point out that there's a major disconnect between the right that he's asserting and the relief that he's seeking. He specifically limited his request for relief to disclosure to his counsel only, potentially subject to a protective order. So Mr. Bryce was not seeking to vindicate the public interest whatsoever and never made any arguments about the public's greater good in knowing what was in these proceedings until his reply brief before this court. So we would point out that this is not really a First Amendment case at all. It's simply a defendant who failed to raise his due process argument and Jinx Act argument, trying to get a second bite at the apple by opening a collateral First Amendment proceeding. And we think that this court should just affirm the district court's opinion. It can do so in the way that this court suggested this morning by simply assuming that the right exists and then finding that the district court made the proper. Yes, Judge?
To the extent the witnesses in similar cases are concerned about being detained as witnesses, there's, of course, procedures for them to challenge that directly, right?
That is correct. There are numerous safeguards built into the material witness statute. These witnesses are entitled to court-appointed counsel, and indeed were given said counsel here. They can file a motion under Rule 15 seeking a deposition that will secure their release. One of them tried to do that, well, did file that here, but the district court declined it. They can also, they're more than welcome to contact their attorneys or the press at large. And they can also appeal their conditions of release under the provisions of the Bail Reform Act. So it's not like we have a situation here where there are no safeguards built in and we have a significant threat of abuse or anything like that. I mean, Congress has carefully calibrated a system here to allow the government to confine witnesses in a very narrow set of circumstances. And we think that the government fully abided by those requirements here. I would also point out that, just as a general matter, the government doesn't have an obligation to disclose to the defendant the names of its witnesses prior to trial. The defendant doesn't have a right to that information under the Due Process Clause, as the Supreme Court has found and this court has repeatedly observed. Neither does the defendant have a right to that information prior to the witness testifying under the Jinx Act. But really what he's seeking here is sort of a discovery device that would allow him to get the names of witnesses prior to trial, if indeed this right kicks in, like he suggests, at the post-indictment phase. It would allow him to discover the names of witnesses prior to trial. And we think that that's a bad idea for numerous reasons. One is that the government has a significant interest, just as a general matter, in protecting the names of its witnesses prior to trial. That interest is protecting them from the threat of any sort of intimidation leading up to trial. And I would point out that even in the case of material witnesses, there's a strong presumption in favor of releasing these witnesses back into the public. They may have to post bond, they may have certain limitations on their ability to travel and whatnot, but they are often released because that's what the Bail Reform Act actually calls for. So this would actually give defendants a way to find out the names of witnesses prior to trial, and we think that that would be a bad idea and would fly in the face of the system that Congress has set up, in which we're not required to disclose the names of witnesses prior to trial except in capital cases, and also would fly in the face of the Supreme Court's precedent, which says there's no due process right there. I'd also like to turn this court's attention to 3509 for a moment. We think that the defendant never raised this claim below. He's asserting now that this provides him an independent basis for relief, but he never made that argument in the court below, and we don't think any reasonable district judge in this position would have understood him to be saying that. He simply said that he would abide by whatever reasonable conditions the court thought necessary or deemed appropriate. But now he's arguing that 3509 didn't allow the district court any discretion, but instead mandated that it release these documents in redacted form. So we think that Mr. Bryce has waived whatever claim that is, and if this court reviews it at all, it should review only for plain error. But on the merits there, we don't think that he has the right interpretation of the statute. In 3509, which is entitled the Child Victims and Child Witnesses Rights Act, Congress was creating simply a system to provide a baseline of protection for the identities and information about child witnesses and victims. It was not seeking to create a public disclosure statute, something along the lines of FOIA, which Mr. Bryce suggests. The statute even has a disclosure provision in it, 3509D4. But by its very terms, that provision doesn't require the district court to disclose anything to the defendant. Instead, it just prohibits the district court. It says the district court is not prohibited from releasing information regarding the child's name or other information to the defendant. So The defendant here is really trying to stand the purpose of this statute on its head, change it from a privacy provision into a public disclosure provision. I think there's no evidence that Congress intended that, and it would have been extremely odd, because if his reading of the statute is correct, district courts would be fully permitted, assuming any common law or other First Amendment rights are complied with, to seal entire documents involving adult victims, but could never do so in cases involving child victims. It's extremely unlikely that Congress intended that anomalous result, especially in a statute like this, which Mr. Bryce does not contest, was aimed at expanding protections for children. If this court has no further questions, we would submit that it should affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right, thank you. All right, why don't you take 2 minutes, Mr. Jefferson?
The government faults appellant for not using the word redaction in before the district court, but as I noticed, stated earlier, we requested it under whatever conditions the court deemed appropriate. More importantly, the law places the burden in this area on, again, the government. It is the government's burden, or the whoever is trying to seal the proceedings, and in this case, that's the government. The government's burden to demonstrate that available alternatives will not protect the compelling governmental interest. So it was not appellant's burden in the district court to argue for, to show, to suggest all the reasonable alternatives. It was the government's burden to show that those would not work. And that's directly from Press Enterprise 1. Most of these things are directly from Supreme Court cases. Also in Supreme Court, in Press Enterprise 2 is the argument that conclusory assertions, which is all we have here on considering reasonable alternatives, conclusory assertions are not enough. The Supreme Court specifically rejected a conclusory assertion on why compelling governmental interests would be harmed. In Press Enterprise 2, the court stated that the First Amendment right of access cannot be overcome by the conclusory assertion that, end quote, a compelling governmental interest would be harmed. So the kind of
Something short, always conclusory?
What's that?
Something short, always conclusory? Short explanation can be a reasoned explanation, can it?
But the only statement here on reasonable alternatives is, quote, that no reasonable alternatives exist that would prevent that. That is conclusory statement. Okay. And, you know, the cases are very clear. If you look at the cases, the consideration of reasonable alternatives is very thorough when the judge complies with the procedural prerequisites here. So that's what's incumbent on the judge to do, we would suggest, on remand, is to go through the reasonable alternatives, state the reasons why they're not acceptable, if they're not acceptable. In theory, the government's idea that there are these investigatory details that should be kept under seal, in Washington Post versus Robinson, this court did recognize that that can be the case, theoretically, that a governmental interest in the witnesses' identities, governmental witness interest in the direction of their investigation, theoretically that can be a compelling governmental interest that would support sealing material, such as the witnesses' identities. But what the government has wrong is that that's something to consider under the First Amendment test. It's not a reason not to apply the First Amendment test, which is the position they're advocating, but it's something to consider under the First Amendment test in assessing whether there is a compelling governmental interest. And it's something that this court would do under that framework, and not by saying material witness cases are categorically precluded from the First Amendment right of access.
All right, you need to wind it up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.